Hi, welcome to LA Lit. We're here with Will Alexander. LA Lit is a interview show where we interview writers from Los Angeles or writers who happen to be in Los Angeles. We are at la-lit.com, and we're here at Beta Level in Chinatown, Los Angeles, which is at betalevel.com, and we're hosted by Superbunker, superbunker.com, so there's three websites for you. like I say, we're here with Will Alexander, and we're going to be talking to him today, and he's going to be reading from some of his various books that he's had out in the past few years. And I'm Matthew Timmons.
I'm Stephanie Ryu. And Will Alexander is a poet and visual artist working in Los Angeles. His poetic works include Exobiology as Goddess, Asia and Haiti, Above the Human Nerve Domain, Toward the Primeval Lightning Field, which is actually essays, and the Stratospheric Canticles. He has two works forthcoming, a novella, Alien Weaving, from Green Integer, and a book of poems, Sri Lankan Loxodrome, from Canopic Press. There are actually other works forthcoming as well. His most recent book, a trilogy of novels, Sunrise and Armageddon, is out from Spuiten Duyvil, and the International Biographical Center in Cambridge, England, named Will Outstanding Scholar of the 20th Century, and he was also recognized by the Whiting Foundation for Exceptional Literary Achievement. In 2002, Will received a Fellowship for Poetry from the California Arts Council. Welcome to our show, Will. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that. I guess we'll start off with a reading.
Yeah.
And what I was going to start with was from Above the Human Nerve Domain. And it's a piece that I started one night when someone had requested new material, and I had submitted some stuff that was previously written. And the person says, well, no, we would like something a little fresher. And the book immediately poured itself into view. And the initial poem was this one that I'm going to read from. It's called The Impalpable Brushfire Singer. No, he is not an urn singer, nor does he carry on rapport with negative forces within extinction. He is the brushfire singer who projects from his heart the sound of insidious subduction, of blank anomaly as posture, of opaque density as ash. He, distanced from prone ventricular stammer, from flesh and habit and draught, the performer, part poltergeist and orisha, part broken and cellular dove, part glance from floating Mongol bastions, where the spires are butane, where their photographic fractals are implanted with hypnosis. Because he allegedly embodies a green necrotic umber, more like a vertical flash or a farad, posing like a tempest in a human chromium palace. Therefore, his sound, a dazed sea moon in a gauntlet, a blizzard of birds burned at the touch of old maelstroms. Because he gives off the odor of storms, this universal orisha, like a sun that falls from a compost of dimness, out of deproductive hydrogen sums, out of lightless fissures which boil outside the planet. Yes, he sings at a certain pitch which has evolved beyond the potter's field, beyond a tragic hummingbird's cirrhosis, surmounting primeval flaw, surmounting fire which forms in irreplaceable disjunction. Under certain formations of the zodiac, he is listless. He intones without impact. His synodic revelations no longer of the law of measured palpable destination, because he sings in such a silence that even the rishis can't ignore. As though the hollow power which rearises from nothingness perpetually convinces like a vacuum which splits within the spinning arc of an intangible solar candle. Such power can never be confusedly retraced because it adumbrates and blazes. like a glossary of sun, so that each viral drill, each forge casts a feeling which insaturates a pressure, bringing to distance a hidden and elated polarity. Like a subjective skill corroded and advanced, he sings beyond the grip of a paralytic nexus, where blood shifts beyond the magnet of volume, where the nerves no longer resonate inside an octagonal maze stung at its source by piranhas. I'll read another several selections from this particular work. These are orchids that are exist in the upper world. And they cast fractals across the imaginary plane. And I call them the magnetic chartreuse orchids. Intense ulterior fragments like a circle of carnivorous chartreuse. The orchids, a scented chronicle of ghost, burning, kinetic, avernal, as if alighted from Ceres or Phobos, as if baffling existence with magnetic surcease taking shape in a channel, as if emitting sound from a palpable electron on Venus, or of electrical anagrams and drainage, or hypnotic forges, or quintessential mazes. These orchids, vessels eclectic with lightning, with blind insidious congealment, with the power of a porous X-ray chalice splayed, like an explosive smoke, like a magnitude poised in psychic ratios and pontoons. Yes, in dazzling guava frigates, traitorous with concealment, their conscious delving grasses floating in translated smoke, in dazzling oracular henbane and stunning aerial stochastic, which compels from the darkness an essence part spell, part flaming chartreuse estrangement in which mnemonic trance co-intuits the visual smaragdina, the orchids being of transmuted herons, of dazed ratios and scents, of gnomic moons galvanic with intuitive hunting omegas. So that the chartreuse orchids, like a sigil of glacial anti-directives, become as condensed galactic fields, like beatific anglistical traces reaching back to the waters and blackened Sphinxian wreckings. So that to imbibe their tenuous calcinations, their obliterated husk, their unmethodical kingdoms, there must exist alluvial substratums, in which one must blaze with the heat of subaqueous aqua suns, of a subtle mongoose supposition, of a flying harrier liquor. So that the relativity of their partial substance as enigma transpires in the body as vacuum, as prone cerulean atomic, so that there is passage, so the senses explode as a ganglia of spectrums. Of course, that which partakes of the orchid's solar disposition, of their ability to mate as centripetal invasives with a green agnostic debility, with that which poses threats to the endemic power of bifurcation as grain, to its reason stalactites, to its frayed and colorless diamonds straining against necromantic osmosis, so that to affect the sanguinary zeal, the pitch, the code of anti-conclusion, the orchids begin blending with a blanched Pavonian calendrix, with eudoxical astromesmerics, with active double eurekas. The next poem is entitled In the Ghostly Eclipse Zones. My relation to zones shifting across anomalous ambits, across anomalous micro weights, impelled by strange alchemical dissensions rife with ghostly umbilical drainage. Like solar zodiacal appearance or suns in deep cerulean de-emergence spinning as a general glossary of vertigo or a de-engendered timber or a burning Uranian necromantic absorbed with spells, with eclipse syntactical flotation. Again, suffering from de-existence, from a source of spiraling eclipse boundaries, so that my motion, baffled, incessant, nuclear with maximal displacement, each gesture hypnotic with bifurcation, with stunned subliminal ciphers, therefore an exfoliation of mangers, of sand, of microscopic riddling pyres, of sight in dazzled electrums. Therefore, I exist like a fish in a smokeless eclipse channel, as a scorching rain that reverses, in that the balance distorts as in a well of a carnivorous metal, or as holographic isolation, or as a sudden tendency to not exist. Like green approximal labor, as though the body were focused by glances, by projection as interior rambling, so that the blood loses weight. Then the carnage dissolves as bloodless theatrical mosaic, as ghost hyperextended in bondage. Life as equivocal grace, as the magnet of theoretical castles. In consequence, my hands flutter in a vat of mirages, having lost the reach of navigable tonics, of magnetized systemics. The reactive heavenly jungles, the newfound Bedouin zeal guarded by flashes of zinc, by sudden inflationary rotations. So that one can examine one's personal pivots, one's shafts, one's origins, the gambled ink of one's grasses, so that the mathematics of debility is no longer tested as dense savagery by production. It's no longer the lateral germination of doubt, the prone expression of consequence as the literal force which unseals me, which scatters my wealth in subnuclear geometry. No one skill provides me, gives blood to my knowledge, not classical verbal concentration nor the gaze. There exists the sonar crystal, the deep camaraderie of darkness, the hesitation by expressive solar degree. So animation is heightened, is squared by cognitional sum, becomes flight in quantum transition, the magic etched in a phantom field in a true penetration by lava. There then exists the mind at the core of a kindled parallel splitting, of a tragic photon connection. Life being the power of wave as missing ensemble, as odd proportioned by lion. Again, stage as holographic ballerina, as impersonal grafting, as magical rotational interblending. Thus, sun in the montage of death with its wasp, its riddles, its hypothetic neurology. This is where I stand on an ocean of somatic glass, near several darkened green emblems, near blazing lunar suspensions. As monstrous and opaque as tense equational substratum, I tend to glow in lessened alabaster memory, in motionless compass, in distance symmetry by perception. The arched monomial meridians, the states of distilled refraction, flare through poisoned infiltrations just to vanish and re-exist, as though a central spectrum had fallen, as though one had lived in spurious magentas, in a magic trinity of geysers, in an outer formica of florets, dispersed as electrochemical permutation, as salt, as cold and iridescent intensity, so that the taxonomic, the ruthless, the single volatility of particles is negative by confined, is panorama by extensive scorpion degree. As rainless methodology, there are ants, there are bleak medicinal diffractions, as directive by sudden befoulment, as floating vipers in a lake, become an open neon obscurity, become a phantasmic hole made dark by a thesis.
Why don't we talk a little bit about those? I think that's a lot. That's a lot for us to take in right away. That's a lot to chew on, so did you have a question?
Yeah. Well, on the back of Stratospheric Canticles, there's a nice, some nice words by Elliot Weinberger that your poetry is like no one else's, and that when read with a dictionary, we can see how precise you are. So it made me wonder a little bit, and I read a little bit about it from an interview, but maybe you could tell us here too, like how you came or discovered poetry and then your particular practice of it being so unique and how it all came together.
Yeah, that's a lot, but you know, it's like mountain building or any force in nature. You know, the human being is a part of this process. And so any reality that's constructed has to go in these stages, and these stages have to interblend, and there's all of these levels of transition that transpire. So there's never just a total break at this point or that point. But I would say that this thing started evolving actually at birth. But it didn't appear. It didn't appear in terms of writing until many, many years later. You know, it took the first 21 years or 22 years of my life to figure out that this was something I was doing and had been doing all along, but not in a verbal sense, but in an intuitive way, in terms of the way I approached reality. And I think poets exist just quite naturally, and if it comes out in terms of music or poetry or painting or other forms and expressions, it tends to develop until you get to a certain crystallization and you find yourself going in a certain direction, if it's one art or another. Mine was poetry.
Well, but you also paint, and what you paint, you write poetry and plays and novels.
And play piano.
And play piano, I guess, too.
It's I don't know. It's just something that exfoliates. I mean, it comes about, you know.
Yeah.
It comes about on its own once the momentum has started. You know, you find your certain directions. You know, I mean, some people are just going to write poetry,
yeah.
And some people write this. It varies. It depends on your leaning. You know, it's not. It's very personal. So I think that there's no template in that regard. You know, that's all. I mean, look at, Octavio Paz influenced all these Latin American novelists, but he never wrote a novel.
Yeah.
And Borges the same way. You know, they you have your own unique breathing.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I see it.
So being so unique then, as a teacher of poetry, as a guide of poetry in a university class, some of the classes that you teach, so how do you guide your students then to find those personal or unique things for themselves?
Well, first of all, I give them the idea that you are bringing the poetry already. You don't have to open a book, you already have brought the poetry to you, because when you find an expression in a book of poetry, it's a certain kind of a tendency towards language that's already inbuilt in terms of your likes, your dislikes, your particular traumas, your joys, your transcendence, your depressions. All of these come into play in terms of the way that you express yourself. It's kind of like something, to use a mundane terminology, the way that people wear out heels on their shoes. And this may seem very, very odd, but a certain person may walk with a certain balance a certain way. And it's all walking, too. Or you see people with these weird walks where they swing their arms like really, or some people saunter. You know, well, you transmute that into the internal space, you know, and you find a certain kind of a leaning towards this the array of language or that array of language, this subject or that subject. And that way you begin to tap into a certain kind of a tendency that can be understood as being unique to that particular individual.
Yeah. You know, reading about you and your work, like, you know, kind of out, not just reading your work, but reading people writing about your stuff, various interviews you've done, stuff like that. I was interested because everybody, or a lot of people, like to associate you with some kind of surrealism, some kind of like updated or more contemporary surrealism, and I think you write a little bit about André Breton and some of your essays and stuff like that, and other surreal kind of modes. And just now you're talking about how the poetry is kind of like inside of people, and it's not like you have to dredge it up, which makes me think about the kind of automatic writing. You can just kind of, you know, sit down and let it come out. Mm-hmm. And you are very prolific in kind of in that way. But as I read your work, I associated you more with the kind of someone you brought up earlier today, like a Raymond Roussel, or even, you know, kind of in a slightly different matter, the pataphysicians, or that kind of imaginative solutions. A lot of it seems like, you know, what you're doing is defining these manifestations. And I don't know if you can talk about, in that sense, like, I'm not asking you to associate yourself with any particular movement, but tell me a little bit about, you know, how you go about, you know, in each of the poems, especially the last one and the first one, you're kind of creating this persona, this manifestation, and you're you know, using similes to kind of, like, say, it's like this, but not quite like this, or it's like this. And tell me about these kind of poetic manifestations. You know, why you find that a particular mode to write in, or?
It's my tendency, and I discovered this language was mine, this feeling, I should say, for language was mine before I even started writing as relates to what I previously said. I had started listening to John Coltrane's music when I was about, I'd say about 13, 14 years old. And I had heard this, it was something he was doing there that I could relate to personally. And I mean really personally. And when I discovered this wellspring of language, I found out about somehow Rimbaud. And nobody guided me to these books. I found them on my own. And I read a small little book on Rimbaud, and I said, that's me. And I began to compose my first poem that night. And then from that point, I began to find there were ways to work with language that would fit my situation in terms of my feeling of explosion, this feeling of a need to ascend or fly. And the surrealists were people that were, you know, talking about this and were working on it and had been in this research for, you know, obviously many years, you know, prior. So, you know, it was just a natural hand and glove for me. Certainly not ideological.
Hmm. So going back then to the part about your language being precise, for me reading it, it's... my first experience reading your work was, and I think others have echoed this too, you know, this sensation of vertigo, like, whoa, what's going on here? And you know, fascinated by what you're doing with so many, for me it was very adjectival, lots of adjectives coming in, and what are these things, and what do they mean? So, you know, the precision comes in, but then at the same time I feel like there's like this alchemical transmutation going on with things, you know, on the one hand, like with the orchids, you'll have sort of an alter plane event or being, but yet, you know, so integrated with the material of our being here, mm-hmm. where we are now, that it's like both, you know, precision and just like bleeding through of everything.
Well, to me, writing has always been like a yoga. People says, well, you know, go meditate or join a meditation assembly or circle. And I find that once the writer is involved at this level of hypnosis, it's like a hypnotic, you know, that is your way through. That is your way through. It's writing. And so what was crucial for me was to discover not only work with the subconscious mind, but the concert of minds between the subconscious mind, the conscious mind, and the supraconscious mind, which the West has really never taken into account. You know, René Dumas has talked about this, though. You know, the savoir of poetry, that which rises above. Well, Sri Aurobindo from 1914 to 1919 took the supraconscious level and was doing automatic writing from that level. Huh. The Life Divine in particular is one of the greatest tomes. And it has been said in certain critical assessments that if there was only one book you read in this life, that would be the one book to read. So I discovered the supraconscious level from this contact point in Sri Aurobindo. And so I've been able over time to, you know, as you weave and reweave your thoughts and tendencies, you begin to integrate this triple mind and it becomes an actual living inferno out of which, you know, the words, you know, erupt.
Pulling off that, and also things I've thought about as while reading your work, even though in the West it has tended to be ignored, there's always been this undercurrent, you know, Western occult magic and this whole tradition that sort of never went away. It's just not on the front page. That refers to that kind of mind. And there's, you know, Enochian magic mentioned a few times and things like this. So I wondered, well, you must have read in those traditions.
Well, I was looking at the Kemetic or Egyptian tradition as being of vital importance to this planet, because you see a combination of things working intuitively in those societies. And I would not say that any society is perfect, of course, but you know, certainly you didn't seem to have the fractures and the tendencies to fracture that you have found in the past 400 or 500 years in the West. And you got to remember that all the systems of knowledges that we are working with today were actually formed in Africa, and which is not given or stated that way ever. And the surrealists were the activity of this underground activity of African African power. And I think that was one of the reasons it's been subconsciously rejected on so many planes. But at the same time, it's really true. I mean, my friend, late great Philip Lamantia, told me that he was a Pan-African writer. He was Afrocentric. He was Afrocentric. Told me this, and this is what we're talking about, because we're talking about a power. And not necessarily a color. We're talking about a power of the imagination. And this is what's so inclusive, because all the mathematical systems were started there, all the philosophical systems, you know, you understood the sciences of water distribution, you know, farming.
Music scales.
Musics, you name it. In other words, it was all there in a completed form. And so to work with the original set of vibrations rather than a received set of vibrations, you know, so the original tremor is set up. And this is what I heard in John Coltrane's music, was this original force. And it allowed me to go straight to the source rather than to get into the refinement of measure or the refinement of the lesser planes to get to the greater plane. As Edward de Bono says, sometimes you just go straight to the source. And the painter Soutine helped me to do this at a crucial point. As you may or may not know, Soutine never drew. He went straight to the paint. And so de Bono like concurs with that by saying, well, you sometimes have to go to the top of the mountain and then find your way back down. Explain to them later.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to read from your novel, and then we'll take a break?
Okay. This is going to be a fairly old 5-10 minute excursion here. This is going to be from the title.
And this is a new novel that just came out recently, Sunrise and Armageddon.
From
right?
Spite and Dival, yeah. It's three novels in one, but they're all they go together. When I did this book, 19. Actually, this book was finished in the 94 or 95. I did about within that period. I did the Asian Haiti and Stratospheric Canticles, and there's another one, Impulse of Nothingness, that has not been printed yet, but it's coming out, and these three books. So I went on a quest for the 3 or 4 years where I just turned out all the two levels. So in other words, at that point, I was working with that compression and that purity, you know, which is like to put all this condensation together. And by the way, when I say this, too, I'm talking about what the Kemetic or Egyptian society was talking about was the use of the right brain, not the left brain, but the synthesizing mind. And so and that's another tendency. I'm naturally right-brained person. I have to struggle with the left brain. It creates fatigue. For me, and I think most people are fatigued by going a step at a time. You know, it's like you got to make those great leaps. You know, like Eric Dolphy used to make those incredible leaps, those intervals, man. You know, it's so. This is just what I was doing, making leaps. And this is the voice of a woman who has run away from her oppressive kind of condition in her home, but it's symbolic of the whole situation of freedom, you know, as opposed to repression. Freedom to let the imagination soar. And that's just what her quest is about. So let me try a number of pages here. And this is from the actual last book in the trilogy called Sunrise and Armageddon. And this is the end of her quest, where in this book she's gone through all these magical dramatics with the family and with the occult, and now she's working with the space of the cells, where she's transmuting the cells from dross into light through language. She says, "When I started on my path of devious prolixity, conviction was my only crime. I knew in my heart none of life's agonies could uproot my lava. Instinctively, I chose seeming dementia as a coloring, fumaroles as a spine. I chose his work transposed glyphs, symbolic and mnemonics, weaving my way across a Costa Rican Ouija board. Because at this stage, I have come to the opportune decisiveness of finally forgetting my own person, forgetting how my habits were initially flawed, forgetting how I contentedly swallowed my invisible halcyon offspring. Because to drop to a level of less viable ether would be to transgress my organic vial of agony. The latter condition would debilitate my angry radical drafts and draw into my person a lake of sated monsoons. It would keep me jettisoned, circumscribed, borrowed. Therefore, I take on the food of spinning sun gold whispers, of an oracular vat of scorching reindeer teeth, thereby invading the thrones on blazing tropical cliffs. I recall to myself, had Hapshit, part in celibate, part battalion commander in flesh. Therefore, one can say I've leapt the chronological debilities and fearlessly studied the medicine of dialectical organics. Therefore, I know a reasoning dread, a retaliatory prism, implying a persona escaped from the power of old surgical reductions. Because this is not, I must remind my listeners, sequential battle prosperity. Because I have never forfeited plagues, have never gone back on the force of my memoirs of ferocity. I have never reached those culpable stages of prosperity in order to diagnose the detail of stronger or weaker dyslexias of victory. If I could pull from my fascist old Numidian hesitations and chronicles, no one would tend to doubt me or bury my ire with codes from ancient sea lion's blood. But I exist as a fulminant hygira, mentally angled by blackened coronal suspension. Smoldering formulae, darkened necromancy statutes, like watching nerves in a window of Mars, like watching fractional mental jurisprudence, overcoming cold substantial relic. One fundamentally ceases to balance according to metrification and clarity. One tarries. One sets out on lost ambitional missions, entangled in leakage, in simultaneous verbal spells under a canopy of lighted Borneo edicts. Yet I refuse to predict myself by ruthlessness, by sundering my oasis of preponderance, compromised by rays from a greenish saturnine abyss. Yes, to throw myself on top of psychic larvae, to conduct my voice with loosened smeltering wires, would coalesce with nothing less than waking pollutional terror. But I can say without broken honesty that I have transcended each electrical morass, each pond of electrical entrapment. By this I mean that I've sheltered myself and exposed myself to blank theoretical abasement, which by my shamanist mantras I've transmuted. I've discarded my old confused compunctions so that each mutagenic decree I've given over to long conversations with my umbra, with my uncounted omens, with my blue equational roulette. Through alchemic sincerity, I can no longer bewail demonic attack on my person, because through test and countertest, I can now liberate doses of fire onto reinforced human habitation concerning metamorphosis by the lightning of insight. Power is thus ensconced by the riverine of non-parameter, far beyond the popular conception of witches and cataleptic sorcery reunions.